I've been instructed that okay, how many people can hear me at the moment? Okay, so if you can't hear me, then move up closer and hopefully it'll get better. Or maybe they could turn the microphone up a little bit. I'd like to thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity to destroy my voice yet again. Yes, I should apologize so that I'm not so easy to hear. So if my voice gives out partway through, maybe we'll take a little break. I should also say that nothing of what I'm saying has anything to do with me. I've never actually done any work on quasi-categories myself, but I was asked to introduce them so that people could understand what was going on later today. Most of what I'm going to say is due to Andre Jayal, but bits of it are also due to other people, such as Boardman and Volk, who invented quasi-categories, and Cordier and Porter, and Jacob Lurie, and Josh, who will be talking later today, and some other people. So what I want to do this morning is give some idea of what quasi-categories are and why you should care and what you can do with them. So that what sort of structures we use in working with them, so that you're better able to understand the talks later today on more complicated things that people are doing with quasi-categories. So the idea of a quasi-category for us is that it's a model for what John was calling infinity one categories yesterday. An infinity one category is intended to mean an infinity category all of whose cells above dimension one are invertible. You can think of them as higher homotopies if you like, if you're a homotopy theorist. Maybe I should mention that the terms infinity category and omega category are generally used to mean pretty much the same thing, unless you happen to be Jacob Lurie, in which case infinity category means what we are calling an infinity one category here. So why should you care about infinity one categories in particular? Well, John gave one reason yesterday, which is to compare various different kinds of structures which are intended to be the same. So as John said, you can regard a model category as being a presentation of an infinity category. And model categories function very well as presentations of infinity categories, and frequently we can express an equivalence of infinity one categories using an equivalence of model categories. But it's also useful to have some notion of what it is that the model categories are presenting. And because sometimes the model categories are too rigid or too strict, and we'd like to work in a little bit weaker context. By way of analogy, I like to say that it's useful to have the notion of generators and relations to present a group, but it's also useful to know what a group is, independent of any particular choice of generators and relations. So frequently it's nice to know what we mean by an infinity one category. Another reason you might care is if you want to actually do category theory inside of some infinity one category. For example, supposing that you might be interested in studying limits and colimits in this infinity one context. Model categories do have a notion of homotopy limit and colimit, but again, those are sometimes too rigid. For example, every model category has homotopy limits and colimits, but so if you want to talk about some infinity one category that doesn't have limits and colimits, then with the model category, you're out of luck. So you want some more flabby or weaker structure that can have less structure on it. So this is sort of Jacob Lurie and his friends' motivation for studying these things. They want to talk about infinity stacks. So just the way that algebraic geometers are led to what we might call a 2-1 category, or categories of groupoids or stacks in groupoids, in order to study things with automorphisms. If you want to study things with higher automorphisms and talk about higher stacks, then you need some sort of higher category theory like this infinity one category theory. So much for infinity one categories. What about quasi-categories? So there are a number of different models for infinity one categories. John talked about simplicially enriched categories yesterday. That's a good model. There's also a couple of others that Julie's going to talk about later this morning. And each of them has advantages, but quasi-categories have a good number of advantages. For example, they're what you might say intrinsically weak. In a simplicially enriched category, the morphisms in the Hom spaces we can think of as weak infinity groupoids if they're con complexes, but the horizontal composition of, say, of one morphisms is still strictly associative, which is good enough for many purposes, but sometimes it's a little bit too strict, and we'll see some examples of that later. Whereas in a quasi-category, in the language of quasi-categories, it's difficult to even say what you mean by a strict infinity one category. Everything is sort of intrinsically weak. So that's useful in some cases. Another advantage of quasi-categories is that they're a little bit more compact than the other versions in the layman's sense rather than the mathematical sense. They involve less complicated data. A quasi-category is just a single simplicial set, rather than a whole bunch of simplicial sets like you have in a simplicially enriched category. These other models can be thought of as bisimplicial sets, which again is a little bit more complicated. And perhaps, at least partially for these reasons, category theory works a little bit better in quasi-categories than it does in many of these other models. And André Géhel and Jacob Lurie and other people have done a lot of work showing that you can actually extend large amounts of the ordinary theory of ordinary categories to the setting of quasi-categories. So in some sense, the moral of that is that infinity one categories are a lot more like one categories than they are like infinity categories. They behave a lot more like the ordinary categories that we're used to, just sort of done up to homotopy, rather than two-category theory or three-category theory or n-category theory. All right. So what is a quasi-category? So let's start out by looking again at the nerve of an ordinary category, which we looked at a little bit yesterday. The nerve functor embeds categories fully and faithfully in simplicial sets. And yesterday we were thinking about the n-simplices of the nerve of a category as the strings of n composable arrows. Now, this is the same functor, but I want to think about the n-simplices a little bit differently. So, if I have a category C, I'm going to draw pictures of the low-dimensional simplices in its nerve. So the zero simplices of its nerve are just the objects of the category, and the one simplices are just the arrows. And because all of our simplicial sets are going to be like nerves of categories, or thought of as like nerves of categories, I'm going to draw my one simplices with a direction, which they actually do have in the structure of a simplicial set, although when you do homotopy theory, you generally ignore the direction. Okay, so far so good. Now, something in here is a composable string of two arrows, but of course, in a category, they also have a composite. So if I have a two simplex with these boundaries being arrows in the category, I want to think about this as the assertion that H is equal to the composite of F and G. So in other words, the composition of the category is encoded in the two simplices. The other algebraic structure of a category is its identities, and the identities here are encoded differently. The identities are encoded in the degeneracy maps of the simplicial set. Right? So for every zero simplex of a simplicial set, we have a degenerate one simplex on it, and here that degenerate one simplex is the identity on that object. they're treated a little bit differently here. Now, a 3-simplex, I'm going to think of as like a tetrahedron. So here are my 3 composable arrows that form my 3-simplex, and then each pair of them has a composite. And then there's a triple composite, which is in the back. So if this is F and G and K, then this here is GF, and this is KG, and then this here is KGF in the back. And so the fact that I can put just a single arrow to back there encodes the associativity. Right, that KG composed with F is the same as K composed with GF. So all the algebraic structure of a category is encoded in the first 3 levels of its nerve. So the idea of a quasi-category is to weaken the notion of the nerve of a category so that we still have notions of identities and composition and associativity, but sort of only up to homotopy. So if we think about an arbitrary simplicial set as some sort of infinity one category, then what sort of structure ought we to have on it in order that it acts like an infinity one category? So, excuse me. Well, it's got objects, it's got arrows, as it consists of a simplicial set. It will automatically have degeneracies. And therefore, it will automatically have things which act like identities. So what we need to do is ensure that it has composition, which is coherently associative and so on. So for each composable pair of 1 simplices, we need some 2 simplex, which is going to tell us that there's some composite for these 2 arrows. Okay, so a way to say this in homotopy theorist type language is to say that if my simplicial set is X, then whenever I have a map from the 2-1 horn into X, then I can fill that to a map from the 2-simplex into X. Now, this here, John wrote down this notation briefly. I'm going to write it down again. The NK horn is intended, is the N simplex missing one of its faces and the N simplex itself. So for the horn? Okay. I think it's a little bit. This one is a little bit less confusing because the N is upper on both of these, but people definitely use the other one as well. That's a good point. Okay. So the fact that there's composition can be expressed as a lifting property of this sort. Where we're going to regard now the 2 simplices in our simplicial set as talking about composition in some way. So now what about, say, associativity? So we'd like to be able to say that composition is associative in some sense. We'd also like to be able to say that composition is somehow uniquely defined. Now over here in the nerve of a category, there's a unique 2 simplex for every F and G. Again, namely the one that exhibits their composite as their composite. But what we're going to do for a quasi-category is we're going to regard a 2-simplex as being specifying some composite rather than necessarily the composite. So this is what you might call a non-algebraic approach to a higher category. Now, you want some sort of uniqueness, but that uniqueness is going to be up to homotopy in some higher sense, which is determined by, again, by the 3 simplices and the 4 simplices and so on. So, and all of that, all of those conditions can be encoded in the filling of certain horns. And John told us yesterday that a Kahn complex, which we think of as an infinity groupoid, is determined by being able to fill all horns. For a quality category, we only require ourselves to fill some horns. So let me write down the definition, and then I'll explain why it gives us everything that we want in order to have some sort of notion of infinity one category. Inner horn is a special kind of horn where we require the index k to be strictly between 0 and n rather than between 0 and n inclusive. So I'm going to write that down. So if we have a map from an inner horn to x, then we can fill it to a map from the simplex if k is between 0 and n strictly. And it's worth remarking that this filler is not necessarily unique. In general, there will be many different fillers. But if all those fillers are unique, then you recover the notion of the norm of a category. So there are various different ways to characterize the simplicial sets, which are norms of categories, and this is one of them. So every category is a quasi-category in particular. So why does this notion give us operations of composition and associativity and so on? So I'm just going to give some intuition for why this is the right thing. So we've already seen that we have some kind of composition operations. Being able to fill three horns is then going to tell us that we have some sort of associativity. And also that the composition is some sort of unique. So suppose we have two simplices which exhibit H is a composite of F and G, and J is a composite of K and G, and then maybe we'll have G, K, J, J, F will compose to some other thing, L. And so we'd like to say that L is also a composite of H and K. H and K, which will give us some sort of associativity. So what we should do is we look at the three simplex with one face missing. So we put F here and G here and H here, and then our composite of F and G is Our composite of F and G is H, our composite of K and G is J. So these are the front two simplices of my three simplex are here, and then this back morphism here is going to be L, and I know that the composite of F and J is L, so this top two simplex here has something in it, but this bottom simplex is missing, and the inner three simplex is missing. Now, this is an inner three horn. I think it's either lambda 3, 1 or lambda 3, 2. I can never remember which. 1. Thank you. And so if X is a quasi-category, then this lives inside of X, and so we can fill it to a three-simplex. And in particular, that means that there will exist a two-simplex down on the bottom which exhibits L as a composite of H and K. Right? So our composition, if we think of composition as an operation, it is associative in some sense. You can also use a similar argument to show that if you have two different compositions of the same pair of arrows, then they're related by some two simplex, where one of the where the other third boundary is a degeneracy. So we can think of that as a homotopy between those two. So any two composites of the same thing are homotopic, of the same pair of things are homotopic. So this Hornstein condition gives us associativity and uniqueness, and then the higher Hornstein conditions will give us sort of essential homotopical uniqueness of this three simplex, which exhibits the associativity, and so on. So people from homotopy theory may be familiar with this sort of higher coherence that we need to include in category theory. It corresponds to the coherence axioms and so on, which become just higher dimensional cells in an infinity category.
So this notion of one cell being homotopic that you just said, a priori, you've got two notions, you've got left homotopy, right.
Right. You can again prove that they're the same using another Hornstein condition of higher dimension. That's a good point. Any other questions? All right. So let me write down some examples of quasi-categories. I already said that any category is a quasi-category, because the way we just take its nerve and then it has this unique Hornstein condition. A slightly more interesting example, or a slightly more higher example, is any 2-1 category. Now by this I mean a 2 category in which all the 2 cells are invertible. So for example, the 2 category of groupoids, or of stacks in groupoids. You can construct a nerve of this thing and show that it is in fact a quasi-category. So Another example. Is any con complex is a quasi category, which is fairly obvious because in a con complex all horns have fillers. So K is allowed to range from 0 to N inclusive for a con complex. And John already explained why we can think about a con complex as an infinity groupoid, because filling the other two horns essentially gives us inverses to all the one simplices. You can also characterize the con complexes as the quasi-categories such that every one simplex has an inverse. So if I have a quasi-category, then it's a con complex if and only if every one simplex, thought of as an arrow from X to Y, has an inverse G up to homotopy. So there's some two simplex exhibiting the composite of F and G as the identity, or meaning the degeneracy, and some other two simplex exhibiting the other composite. So there are various ways to characterize this. You can also characterize it in a more globally coherent way, but it turns out to be equivalent to this one. Yeah, just like in a category. Yeah. I should also mention that so we have the full subcategory of simplicial sets determined by the con complexes, and this is the full subcategory determined by quasi-categories, then this is an inclusion, and there's a right adjoint to this, which takes sort of the maximal sub-con complex of a quasi-category, which you can think about that as the maximal sub-infinity groupoid of an infinity one category. Okay, some other examples which are more like how quasi-categories tend to arise in practice. If I have a simplicially enriched category, I can generalize the nerve construction of an ordinary category to give me a quasi-category. So you can call this the homotopy coherent nerve, or various other things. And the idea is that you take the homotopies in the Hom simplicial sets to give you the higher simplices in the nerve. I'm not going to give the actual definition. I think Julie is going to talk about it more in her talk, because it's part of one of the equivalence with simplicial categories. But the important result here is that if C is locally con, meaning that all of its Hom simplicial sets are con complexes, then its homotopy coherent nerve is a quasi-category. So this is sort of a better notion of infinity one category, because the Hom categories are actually infinity groupoids, and then we get a quasi-category. So this is how frequently people come up with quasi-categories in practice, is they start with some explicitly enriched category and apply this coherent nerve. For example, if you start with a model category, then you can form its simplicial localization in a way that nobody has talked about yet, but you can make a simplicially enriched category out of a model category, and then do this to it, and you'll get a quasi-category, which you can then regard as the infinity one category presented by that model category. And then I also want to mention the example of quasi-categories that was the original motivating example, which is Borgmann and Vogt's category of homotopy algebras and homotopy morphisms. If you don't know what operads are, then you might want to turn off for a few seconds while I briefly explain this for the people who do know. So, if this is an ordinary operad, Borgmann and Vogt constructed an operad WO, which you can think of as a co-fibrant replacement for O in the category of operads, An algebra for WO should be thought of as a homotopy O algebra, or an O algebra up to homotopy. But now if you want to talk about a homotopy morphism of O algebras, then strict morphisms of WO algebras are not good enough, because they're going to preserve the weak O structure strictly. So you have to sort of weaken your notion of morphism as well. So the way they do this is you also have another operad, which you can write as maybe O tensor delta 1, whose algebras are morphisms of O algebras. Now, this is not an ordinary operad anymore. This is sort of a colored operad, or an operad with different types. So an algebra for this thing is a pair of O algebras together with an O morphism between them. And then you can apply W to this thing. So a W O tensor delta 1 algebra is what they wanted to call a homotopy morphism of O algebras. But the problem is that these things don't compose to form a category. You'd like to have a category of homotopy O algebras and homotopy O morphisms. But they don't compose. But they do form a quasi-category if you include all the higher things. So if you define a simplicial set whose n-simplices are the algebras for W of O tensor delta n, so now delta n is a strict morph algebra for this thing is a string of n composable O algebra morphisms, then this gives us a quasi-category. So if you're a category theorist, you can think about this as making, starting with, say, monoidal categories and forming weak monoidal, starting with strict monoidal categories and forming weak ones, then starting with strict monoidal functors and forming weak monoidal functors. And then in that case, you get a strict two category. But in general, when you do it, you're not going to get a strict category, but you are necessarily going to get a quasi category. Yes?
That's an odd idea. How do you do that with what you saw yesterday with the button
I was just thinking and wondering about that yesterday, whether you could do that with a higher operand as well, to get a quasi-category of weak omega categories and weak omega morphisms. I don't know, but I expect you might be able to do something like that, yeah?
I think this is the idea of that Bakanin wants to use.
Okay.
To find the maps
between
the
entire
following
the idea of both laws. Okay. Great. So, actually, Bergman Book didn't use the term quasi-category. They call it a simplicial set satisfying the restricted Kahn condition. The term quasi-category is due to Andre. Okay, so now I want to say, so we have a bunch of examples. Now I want to say a bit about what you can do with quasi-categories and why they're a useful notion of infinity one category. So, well, we've already seen that weak morphisms of higher categories can be difficult to get a handle on. But with quasi-categories, it's really easy. A weak functor between quasi-categories is just a map of simplicial sets. Now, let's think about what that means. Right, a map of simplicial sets will send objects to objects, morphisms to morphisms, and it'll send two simplices to two simplices. So it's preserving composition in some sense, and it's also preserving all the higher homotopies. But because our composition is only defined weakly, it can't be preserved strictly in some sense. Right? There isn't the composition to be preserved. There's just a composition. Right? So any map of simplicial sets is a weak functor of quasi-categories. Okay, so in other words, that this category of quasi-categories actually is the right category of quasi-categories. Wait a minute. Oh, I did that already. Okay, so another reason that quasi-categories are a good notion is that we have a good notion of product already. So if I have two quasi-categories and I just take their product as simplicial sets, I get another quasi-category, and this is a good notion of the product quasi-category. Now, you should think about this as being almost more like the gray tensor product than like the strict Cartesian product of, say, one categories or two categories. Because what's going on is suppose that I have, let's just do a simple example, right? Everybody remember, what is delta 1 meaning the one simplex? Then the product delta 1 cross delta 1 in simplicial sets consists of a square like this with a couple of two simplices in there. So when I think about this as a quasi-category, this is saying that I have these squares, which you could call F1 and 1G. And then this square commutes only up to homotopy, in some sense. Right? I've got these homotopies in here that tell me that the square sort of commutes. So, so all of my all, the product is just as weak as I might want it to be, but it's just the ordinary product of simplicial sets. Okay, more than functors, we also need to do category theory, we also need natural transformations, right? Natural transformation between functors, between quasi-categories, is just a map from x cross delta 1 into y. And if you look at that, then you'll see that that makes sense, and we should think about this as being like a pseudo-natural transformation. It's got components which the squares commute up to homotopy, but also up to coherent homotopy as we vary all the arrows in X as well. Okay. Moreover, we also have a good notion of a functor quasi-category. I just take the simplicial mapping space, so the internal HOM in simplicial sets. If Y and X are quasi-categories, this is also a quasi-category. In fact, I don't even need X to be a quasi-category, but that's not really so relevant at the moment. And we can think about what? X can be any simplicial set. Just Y has to be a quasi-category. So you can think about that as saying, like, you can just define a diagram in a category defined on a graph rather than on a category. That's the higher dimensional version of that. Okay, so this is a quasi-category whose objects are maps from X to Y, and whose one simplices are, by a junction, just natural transformations, as I just defined them. And the higher morphisms are just what you might expect them to be. So this is a good notion of functor quasi-category. So everything makes sense. And we can just use all the notions of simplicial sets, and everything works out very nicely. Okay. I'm not telling you how to prove any of this stuff, but it's certainly true. The fact that the product is a quasi-category is fairly obvious. The fact that this is a quasi-category is not quite so obvious. Josh might say a little bit more about that, or you can prove it in various different ways. You just have to do some sort of computation with inner horns and so on.
There are efficient ways to do it, so it's hard to find.
Yeah. So that actually leads very well into what I wanted to talk about next, which is the model structure on quasi-categories. Although everything works out really well, it takes a lot of combinatorial work sometimes to prove what ought to be sort of basic results. And so what we'd like is some nice way to encapsulate a lot of those combinatorial results so that once that some person has proven them, like Andre, who's done a lot of this difficult work, that the rest of us can just use them to do quasi-category theory without having to worry about necessarily about all of the details. And one good way to do that is to have a model structure for quasi-categories. So what sort of model structure ought we to expect for quasi-categories? So I want to remind you of some model structures for other sort of categorical structures. So remember that there's a model structure on ordinary categories where the weak equivalences are the equivalences, the cofibrations are the maps which are injective on objects, and the fibrations are the maps which have the lifting of isomorphisms. So let me say what that means a little bit more precisely. Co-completeness. Co-limits. Co-limits of quasi-categories are not necessarily quasi-categories. So, yeah, I'm going to get there. So you have to take it at the model structure on a larger category. Yeah.
But
I don't think so. I'm going to say a little more about that in a minute. But we still think of the model structure as being a model structure for quasi-categories. It's on simplicial sets, yeah. Right. What? Not all limits necessarily. You've got products, but I don't think you necessarily have all limits. All right. Maybe I should say. So I'm going to talk about cat and about two cat, and also the ordinary model structure on simplicial sets, which I want to think about as a model structure for con-complexes. Because the con-complexes are the fibrant objects, and so we think about the fibrant objects as being the ones that we're really interested in studying here. But con-complexes don't have limits and co-limits, so in order to have a nice model structure for them, we need to include all the simplicial sets. Maybe that's historically inaccurate, but that's sort of the way I want to think about it, is that we need to include all the simplicial sets in order to have a nice model structure, but we're interested in the con-complexes, which are the infinity groupoids. So by analogy, we'll have a model structure on simplicial sets where the fibrant objects are the quasi-categories, and then we'll think about that as being wanting to study the quasi-categories, even though we have to include all the simplicial sets in order to have limits and co-limits. So the fibrations in the model structure on cat are the functors which have lifting of isomorphisms. So what that means is that if I have an object of y together with an isomorphism from that object to some other object in x. So maybe I should give these names. And the isomorphism lifts up to y. So I've written this as a lifting property, but you can just write it in terms of in language of categories. Whenever I have an object in x and an isomorphism from the image of that object in x to some other object in x, then that whole isomorphism lifts up to y. So that's what this means. So that's the model structure on cat, where weak equivalences are ordinary equivalences. There's Steve's model structure on two categories, which I mentioned a couple of days ago, where we have the bi-equivalences here, and the co-fibrations are something more complicated, which I don't want to talk about. And the fibrations are the maps which have lifting of isomorphisms in the Hom categories and lifting of equivalences between objects. So, we have lifting of the appropriate sort of equivalence at all dimensions. Now, there's some subtlety, of course, also in terms of what exactly you mean by lifting of equivalence. But I'm going to ignore that for the moment, or actually forever. And now, the other model structure I want to make an analogy to is the one for the ordinary one for simplicial sets, where we're talking about ton complexes. So here, the weak equivalences are weak homotopy equivalences, but between the ton complexes, the weak equivalences are just ordinary simplicial homotopy equivalences. So when we restrict to the objects we're actually interested in, then the weak equivalences become the obvious thing. So the co-fibrations here are just the injections or the monomorphisms. Monomorphic at all levels. And the fibrations are ton fibrations, which are defined to have the lifting property with respect to all horn inclusions. So what I want to say is that you can think about a con fibration as specifying lifting of higher of all equivalences at all levels. Because remember, so if we have some horn inclusion, I can think about this as saying I'm starting out with some n minus 1 thing, or some possible composite of n minus 1 things, and I have some n thing starting there downstairs, and I want to be able to lift that n-dimensional thing upstairs. So here I was lifting one-dimensional things, here I'm lifting one-dimensional things and two-dimensional things, here I'm lifting all-dimensional things. And because every morphism in a con complex is to be thought of as some sort of equivalence, I'm lifting all the equivalences. So for quasi-categories, we expect some sort of combination of these. So in the model structure on quasi-categories, the weak equivalences will be what are called weak categorical equivalences, which I don't really want to define, but you can define them in such a way that it all works. And between quasi-categories, which are the objects we're interested in, they reduce to the ordinary notion that you might expect. So a categorical equivalence which means what you would hope it would mean is that you have functors in either direction together with invertible natural transformations which tell you that the functors are quasi-inverse in some sense. The co-fibrations are, again, the monomorphisms. So I want to make an analogy between these three. The co-fibrations here also involve some free generation of arrows, but that's because this is an algebraic structure, and these are non-algebraic ones. And then the fibrations should have lifting of things which are equivalences at all levels. Right? So at levels, at every level above one, everything is an equivalence, right? So we have two cells and three cells and four cells and so on are all equivalences. So we want to lift all of those. Now, so we should do something like this property to make sure that that happens. But what we want to do is we want to just restrict to the inner horns again, because if we use the outer horns, then we'll end up lifting all of our one simplices too, essentially, which is not what we want to do. So these, in order to get lifting of the two cells and the two cells and higher, we should have we should be what you might call an inner vibration, which is also called a mid vibration, which is defined to be lifting with respect to inner horns. Remember that an inner horn means one of these where k is strictly between 0 and n. Those are the ones that we had to lift to get quasi-categories. And we need to be able to lift the one cells, which are equivalences. Now, I already said what an equivalence is here, right? I mean, again, there are different ways to define it. But these are what I mean by the one-dimensional equivalences. So we impose the lifting of equivalences. In some suitable way. And note that gives us the vibrations in the model structure for quasi-categories. These vibrations have been called, Andres Jarl has called these quasi-vibrations to go with quasi-categories. From a homotopy theorist's point of view, that's a little bit unfortunate because quasi-vibration means something entirely different there. I don't know if I have a better suggestion, though. Anyway, so we have this model structure, so we can use this in various ways to encapsulate facts about quasi-categories, which are useful. So, for example, the fact that the product of two quasi-categories is a quasi-category, and the fact that the Halm from anything to a quasi-category is a quasi-category, follow from the statement that this model structure is a Cartesian closed model structure. So it interacts well with the Cartesian closed structure on simplicial sets. Now, I didn't actually say what that means in my introductory talk on model categories, but you can sort of imagine that there might be some nice condition that works very well. Yes? It's more complicated than that. If you're talking about maps of quasi-categories, then I think you can phrase it as a lifting with respect to some map. But for maps between arbitrary simplicial sets, it's more complicated than that because the maps which ought to be equivalences might not have an inverse which is just a single simplex. It might have a couple of simplices which sort of will end up being its inverse if you were a quasi-category, but they don't actually have a composite. I don't know if that really made any sense, but it actually turns out to be somewhat complicated to say exactly what you mean by that in general. You have any? It is cofibrantly generated, but you have to do a lot of work to show that it is. Do you want to comment on this? It is cofibrantly generated, but well, I can say what the generating cofibrations are the same as the generating cofibrations of the ordinary model structure on simplicial sets. I cannot say what they are in a nice way. Can you? Was there another question? All right. Okay, so in the few minutes that I have left, let me say a little bit about vibrations between quasi-categories. So there are a lot of other ways in which the theory of quasi-categories is very nice, more than I mentioned over here. One of them is the fact that you have nice notions of limits and co-limits, which you can phrase entirely in the world of quasi-categories, which are all sort of limits up to homotopy, or pseudo-limits, or homotopy limits, whatever you want to call them. And another way in which it's nice is that you have nice notions of fibration, of categories, or Grothendieck fibration, or Cartesian fibration, or whatever you want to call it, which you can think of as a quasi-categories or con-complexes parameterized by some other quasi-category. So there are a bunch of different notions of fibration between ordinary categories. So there's this notion of fibration, which I wrote down up there, lifting of isomorphisms, which is for the model structure. I think Steve calls these isofibrations. Did you invent that term? Or so the idea, here we lift only the isomorphisms. There are also other notions of fibration. There's a notion which is sometimes just called a fibration, or sometimes a Grothendieck fibration. And the idea of this is that we allow ourselves to lift arbitrary arrows in a universal way. Here we think about if we have some functor E over B, well, these are both ordinary categories, and we think about the fiber over each object here as its own category, and we think about E itself as a bunch of categories parameterized by B itself. So the morphisms inside these fibers, that is, the morphisms which map down to the identity object down here, we think of as morphisms in the fiber category which is parameterized. But then the morphisms between these categories we think of as encoding the action of some base change functor between these two objects. So each arrow up here will lie over some arrow down here. So let me give this a name. So if I have something here in the fiber over A and something in the fiber over B, I think about an arrow here as a map from this object here to this object pulled back along this arrow to this fiber. So I imagine, or actually I actually can make myself have a functor, or a pseudo-functor actually, from B or from B opposite two categories with a bunch of so that each takes each object here to the fiber up, the fiber over it, and then takes each arrow to a base change functor going in one direction or in the other direction. So for a fibration, fibration corresponds to a functor from B op to cat. This is a pseudo-functor. So, and the way that that pseudo-functor is encoded here is that for every object here which maps down to B and every arrow from F to B, there exists some lift of that arrow here, which has a universal property that every other morphism to this object over F factors through it uniquely. It's called a Cartesian arrow. And the idea is that this arrow here exhibits this object as the image of this object under the functor corresponding to F going backwards, under this pseudo functor. So every arrow in B corresponds to a functor going backwards. Now, again, this is sort of a non-algebraic notion of a pseudo-functor, because just like a quasi-category is a non-algebraic notion of infinity one category, because you could choose lots of different Cartesian arrows, all of which would give you isomorphic pseudo-functors, but not necessarily the same one. So we're not specifying the pullback or base change, we're specifying a pullback or base change, just like we specify a composition in quasi-categories. So in some sense, this is even a better notion that corresponds better to quasi-categories than functors do. So the pseudo-fibration corresponds to pseudo-functor this direction, and then you also have an op-fibration which corresponds to a pseudofunctor, which is covariant. The reversal of the ops is a little bit unfortunate, but we're kind of stuck with that historically. Some people also call this a co-fibration, which is grates on a homotopy theorist's ears. There's a two-categorical reason for that, which is that this is a fibration in cat co. But I think op vibration is better. So each of these has an analog in quasi-categories. So the analog of an isofibration is this thing that I wrote up here. Yeah, I guess you might and then we also have a notion of Gozendieck fibration or Cartesian fibration or whatever you want to call it. So I'm not going to really explain what this is. But it's really a very, very direct generalization of the notion for categories. So first you make it an inner fibration so that you can lift all the higher invertible cells in the necessary way, and then you add some universal lifting condition on the one cells. And so you can think about this as a quasi-category parameterized by X. So the fiber over each zero simplex in X gives me a quasi-category, you can prove. And then I get sort of base change functors corresponding to morphisms, and everything works out in a very nice way. Josh? Andre? Meaning going from a pseudofunctor to a fibration.
Yeah. I'm gonna talk about that.
Okay. So I guess that there's one more kind of fibration which I want to mention. I'm just about done, and Josh is gonna say more about vibrations, but supposing that you want to talk about parameterized groupoids rather than parameterized categories. So maybe you want to talk about stacks or pre-stacks in groupoids. Then it turns out that there's a very nice characterization of those pseudofunctors which land in groupoids by using these fibrations. So you can show that the fibers are all groupoids if and only if every arrow upstairs is Cartesian. So every morphism upstairs has this universal property. It's this universal factorization property that I talked about. So in the world of quasi-categories, the corresponding thing, if you want to talk about higher stacks, maybe, or something like that, would be to want the fibers to be con-complexes. So to make the fibers con-complexes, it turns out that when you do it that way, the corresponding notion to this turns out to be a very nice lifting condition. So this sort of fibration wasn't in general characterized by a nice lifting condition, and neither is this. You have to write it down a little more explicitly, but if you want the fibers to be con-complexes and all the morphisms to be Cartesian, then all you need is another lifting condition with respect to some more horns. So either right or left horns, where here now I mean this means 0 is less than or equal to K can be 0, but not N, or maybe, I forget which is which.
Left is, yeah, that's right.
Okay, so, Okay. So the right or left vibrations have are defined to be knots that have lifting with respect to these. The horns where K is allowed to be N or these allowed to be zero. And it turns out that lifting with respect to these things gives you one of these vibrations where all the fibers are concomplexes, because it makes all the arrows Cartesian. You can see that in a sort of in an intuitive way if you think about what the missing horns, what the extra horns here are doing. Yes?
If you put this lifting
effect to right horn, do you need the extra something? No. That's what I'm saying, is that this actually makes everything work. If you once you want all the fibers to be fine complexes. Yeah, that implies that all the fibers are con complexes. Yeah. So this I just wanted to mention this as another example of how the quasi categories behave nicely, like you would expect categories to behave. And because Josh is going to talk more about vibrations and parameterized things. So that's my introduction to quasi.